Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, this is Life Matters. On ABC Radio National, I'm Richard Adie. Good to be with you. We're going to talk about languages today, learning them at school. I did French for 4 years, and damn near passed, I have you know, but most who learn are better than me, especially if they begin at primary school. That opportunity may be less available in the future, and we'll find out why later on. We begin with some controversial ideas. We're not all equal. Some of us are a lot smarter than the rest of us. There's nothing wrong with elitism. We need to embrace it and come to terms with it. These thoughts come from the American political scientist Charles Murray, a scholar who's no stranger to controversy. He's still probably best known for a book he co-wrote 13-odd years ago, The Bell Curve, which, among other things, linked IQ and race. Dr. Murray is in Australia as a guest of the right of centre think tank, the Centre for Independent Studies, and last night he spoke at the CIS's Big Ideas Forum. We were hoping to have him yesterday, but he's here now. Welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you, Richard.
Now, you've been speaking in defence of elites. You know elites is a dirty word in Australia.
I don't know, Richard, if I've been speaking in defence of elites. Let me rephrase it. You have an elite whether you like it or not. Every society does. And they run the country. And this is not just Australia, it's the United States. By run the country, I mean it is a relatively small cadre of people who write the newspaper columns and produce the movies and make the pharmaceuticals and all the rest of it. So you've got an elite. How do you deal with it?
We're only really comfortable with the idea of elites in sport here, in fact.
That's what everybody says to me. There is some of that in the United States as well, particularly when you are in some low-income schools and you're made fun of if you try to excel in school. But there are large chunks of the United States where that's not, I don't think, as much of a problem as it is in Australia.
So the elite you're talking about are essentially the clever, the people who are brighter than most.
Yes.
And you think that the education system is letting them down.
It's letting them down, and it's also not doing what it should do for the culture. If you start with a proposition, Richard, that they're going to run the country whether you like it or not, it's in our interest to make sure that they're educated to be good citizens, or to put it in a way which may sound awfully idealistic, to educate them to be wise as possible. And whereas you don't have any magic formulas for it, there are a few key things you've got to do. And one of those key things, actually, is, if I may put it this way, they've got to learn what it feels like to fail. I mean, everybody else learns what it feels like to fail in school real quick. Those who aren't clever at all within the first few years and everybody else sooner or later. You have kids in the United States, and I suspect in Australia, who are very bright, who these days can go all the way from kindergarten to graduate school and never have a professor who was unhappy with their best work and never take a course where they have to say to themselves, I'm not smart enough to do this. It's really important that we push them hard.
You know, we have already selective high schools, especially in our largest state, New South Wales, where essentially there are only 20-odd of these, only 17 of them are completely academically successful from memory. But essentially everyone there is super bright.
I don't know these schools from the inside, and I guess my first question is, are these schools demanding on the kids? Do they make good on the promise of holding their feet to the fire?
Well, I don't know either. But they do turn out astonishing university entrance marks in these kids. And I know that you can go from being, you know, one of the outstanding children in your year, and all of a sudden you're in the middle of the pack. And of course, because of the nature of the bell curve, if I may use that phrase, you may go from being the outstanding student in your year to down the bottom of the class.
So, and that's a good sign. But now let's get to the next requirements for what I think these young people need. And that is not just learn how to get good entrance scores, but also learn, for example, ethics and virtue and all of the things we don't study anymore very often or don't study very hard. Because they are not fashionable. They're too judgmental. I want kids to be studying Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. I want them to be studying Confucian Analects, and not just taking a survey course, but be steeped in this. That's another requirement.
This is a classical liberal education you're talking about. We don't have them now. In fact, it goes back to an idea of educating the the class that are going to rule us.
That's exactly right. You know, in the States, if you take these very clever kids and you go to a university and you talk to them after you've given your speech or whatever, oftentimes you have never met such a self-satisfied, smug set of kids in your life because they have been praised constantly. I'm told this is a problem in Australia, too. You never want to criticize children. You always want to give them positive reinforcement. You don't want to hurt their feelings. And a lot of these very bright kids go out into the world thinking they know a lot more than they do know, and also because they're nice, and everybody says they're nice, they've never stopped to think or been forced to think about what it means to be good, which is a more demanding task.
So you're talking about two things, and let's take them one at a time. This idea of failure, mm-hmm. of holding their feet to the fire.
Of humiliating them.
Humiliating them.
The humiliation that comes from having to say, I'm not smart enough to do this. Now, and everybody who takes enough math courses runs into that. I don't care how smart you are. There is a math course out there. Sooner or later, you aren't smart enough.
I remember bumping into my ceiling in only year 11 and until year 10. So the third last year of high school, I was fine at maths. And then in year 11 and 12, the last 2 years, all of a sudden, I got into a realm that was just really beyond me, had to move down from the top stream.
And that's what I want everybody to experience. It's very healthy. So that's part of it. Part of it is this, they have to learn humility. The second part is they have to really understand that being good in this world is a complicated thing. And the third thing I want them to do with their educational system is I want them to be taught to think rigorously and precisely. I want them to have to master the elements of grammar. I master logical fallacies. I want them to have to study probability because so much of what our decisions these days are based in probability. I want them to... what I really like to hire, I guess, is about 10,000 Jesuits to run these schools.
It does sound a bit yes. Jesuitical.
Jesuitical, yes, because another problem we have with our clever kids is they're sloppy. They will make glib arguments and think they're good enough. And when you point out, well, you know, that doesn't follow, or you aren't dealing with the empirical side of this in a rigorous way, they're offended.
Because they have never been taught actually what logic is.
That's right. And so when you say that's a non sequitur, you get a blank stare. Or if they understand what non sequitur means, they're kind of offended that you're being so pedantic about their argument, which they see in their minds as full of beauty and wisdom. And it's not.
So this sloppiness and egocentrism, how does this translate into the roles they play in society? Because they do seem to be doing pretty well all the same.
Oh, they're making out like bandits. These days, brains are worth more in the marketplace than they've ever been, and they're getting worth more and more all the time. I mean, think, for example, about somebody with high math skills but no social skills. We've all met them, you know, the nerd.
Mm.
40 years ago, they could teach math in a college. That's an earned professor salary. That's basically what they were good for. These days, they can make six figures at Microsoft in a heartbeat.
Or they can go off to an investment bank.
Exactly right.
Isn't there more value, though, in trying to persuade them to be college professors for the rest of us? Because it occurs to me that to give them this rigorous Jesuitical education, it's going to cost plenty. And they're already, we'll come back to the idea that these kids are already the winners in a genetic lottery anyway, so they're going to thrive mm-hmm. regardless of what
yep.
we do. But if we're going to invest in them, there's got to be something in it for the rest of us. And there's more in it for the rest of us if they don't all go off to investment banks or law offices.
Let me tell you a story, Richard. I have a friend whose son is at Harvard, just graduated this year. He was in a large suite and he had six roommates, all right? He is the only one who is not going to Wall Street. And you're right. Kids that are that smart should not come out of 4 years at Harvard with six out of seven saying, what I want to do is go and make as much money as I can. There should have been an education there which says, if I want to lead a fulfilling life, a valuable life, and so forth, there are other options I ought to be considering. But the way things are right now, that is not part of the education we're giving them. You can go through Harvard without taking a single solitary course which would force you to think about alternatives to the way you ought to live your life.
This is a real problem for the quality of our public life, isn't it? Leadership.
Yes. First place, think of how degraded a lot of the policy dialogue is. I mean, take problems of poverty, or drugs, you know, problems where there's a lot of human suffering going on, and you listen to the public policy dialogue on them, and it is glib, it is facile. People want to be seen as being nice and have no willingness to confront longer-term, you know, indirect impacts of the policies they propose. I'm not talking left or right here. I'm just talking of people who do not naturally take on the complexities that these problems demand that we take on.
This is the elite we choose, too, the political class. This is the one where we actually get to say who goes in. All the other guys who you've been talking about, that's about genetics and an opportunity.
Although I'm not sure the politicians are the problem here, because you're talking to a man who has about the same respect for politicians as the pigeons of Rome have for statues, a line I stole from an Italian. I'm talking about the policy elites who write in newspapers, on op-ed pages, the kind of people who do the kind of thing I do. And a lot of my complaint about my colleagues' production has nothing to do with whether they agree with me or not. It has to do with the poor quality of the thought that goes into it.
On Life Matters today, our guest is Charles Murray, who's the W.H. Brady Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research in this country at the moment as a guest of the Center for Independent Studies, and gave a talk last night. Those people, the elites that you're talking about, they're often from similar backgrounds. Are we seeking widely enough for that ruling class? If we're going to have a ruling class anyway, this is something that's hard for an Australian to get their head around.
Now,
the idea that we've got a ruling class, whether we like it or not.
Something's happened in Australia that's happened in the United States, and this is the real topic of the bell curve, which hardly anybody knows because hardly anybody read it, including many reviewers. What Dick Hernstein and I argued in the bell curve was that 100 years ago in the United States, most of the smart people in the country were factory workers and small store owners and housewives and so forth. You didn't really have a cognitive elite. Intelligence was throughout the society. As a society moves toward meritocracy, as a society moves toward meritocracy, the good news is the kids on the bottom start going to college. Mm. They start moving up. They're able to express their talent. I'm a case of a son of a man who only finished high school because he didn't have a chance to go to college. All that's changed. Problem is that after meritocracy has been around for a couple of decades, that churning starts to slow down and you start to sift into a layer cake again, because as the smart people get a chance to rise to the top, they marry other smart people,
yeah.
Their kids tend to be smart, and you start to get this stratification of society. It's not perfect. I mean, perfect isn't the right word. It's not complete by any sense, in a sense. But here's a reality that's facing Australia as the United States. A disproportionate number of the really smart kids come from upper middle class homes.
So the way to address this, you're saying, is to, what, test in some way for who our smartest kids are, or just allow that to happen through school, and then invest in them further. These, as I think I've said once or twice, these kids are already winners. They're already going to thrive,
mm-hmm.
And you're basically saying that we should invest more in them.
Yeah, I want to avoid things that have been done in the past where you test kids at 6 or 11 or whatever and then push them into tracks. I'd much rather have it be a self-selection thing, whereby if a youngster thinks that he wants to take a shot at a math class that maybe his teachers aren't quite sure he's ready to handle. But if he wants to take a shot, let him take a shot.
Mm.
And if he makes it, fine. What you don't do is you don't give him a fake grade. You don't change the curriculum just because he wants to take that class. But you also don't serve as a gatekeeper preventing for any child from pushing himself as hard as he can.
You also, and this, it seems counterintuitive from what else you've been saying, you think that too many people go to university, too high a proportion.
Way too many people. Not. It's not that too many people get post-secondary education. Almost everybody should. But what an awful lot of kids who are in four-year universities really want is to learn a profession of some kind or a trade. And sometimes these are quite complex trades. Sometimes there's things simply as simple as being a really good carpenter. But these don't take 4 years. They take much less time, and the four-year university wasn't designed to produce that. The four-year university was designed to teach analytical skills and complex subject matter that intellectually is accessible to a relatively small proportion of the population. That's easy for me to make that case, Richard, if it comes to something like physics.
Mm.
Because if you can't do the math, you can't be
That's
a physics
right.
major. It's harder to make the case for something like economics or psychology because, after all you have to do is read textbooks. But if you actually look at those textbooks, and then you look at the vocabulary in them, the syntax in them, and the kinds of questions that a genuine college education asks, you're talking about verbal skills that maybe 15% of the population have.
You're talking about a change that has happened since, really, I went to university 20-something years ago. When I started in 84, about 10% of my age group went to university. It's much higher than that now. It's, what, 25, 30% perhaps?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and 10% was probably about right. And it's now become a case where the college degree is necessary in the States in order to get into the job interview for a lot of jobs where it shouldn't be a requirement. Employers are using it as a screen. It's not that if you have a sociology degree that you're qualified to do anything in the job market. But if you've been to a good university and gotten good grades and stuck it out for 4 years, it's a convenient screen for the employer. That's a silly way for kids to have to come up with credentials they can provide to prospective employers. It's a fake value that we attach to the BA, and we ought to be doing everything we can to get rid of it.
If we come back to where we began, which is the idea of investing more in our brightest kids, politically that is not an easy sell, is it? In Australia, at least, nobody ever won any more votes by saying we need to be doing more for our brightest people.
In the United States, it's even worse. The No Child Left Behind Act, which is a huge federal effort, is wholly concentrated on having kids meet basic proficiency and does nothing at all for the brightest kids. It is not a politically easy sell, but I'm not sure I need to sell it to governments. I want to sell it to parents, because a lot of the problem now is that parents aren't demanding enough of their children's education. They're the ones who go in and complain when their child gets a B in an exam, and they are not on the teacher's side in terms of wanting rigor and excellence.
What about the parents of average kids or even struggling kids? You don't really have your argument has no appeal for them. You're saying no grade inflation. Let's not mollycoddle them. Let's hold the feet to the fire of the most successful ones, and let's not boost the grades of those who are not bright enough. It's going to get those people on side.
I'm going to say something else to those parents too, which is stop and think for a moment. If you are trying desperately to get your child who is not intellectually, you know, much interested in college, before you try to push him to go that route and maybe end up a low-level white-collar manager, think about the job satisfactions and the income associated with being, let's say, a superb cabinet maker, between being really, really good at a craft where you are engaged every day in challenging tasks that you do really well, which is one of the main sources of satisfaction in life, and compare that with the satisfactions of being a low-level white-collar worker. And I think that one of the worst things we've done, Richard, is to exalt the kinds of jobs you can get with a BA versus other kinds of jobs that we call the trades or the crafts or blue-collar jobs. I think we have lost sight of what it is that a vocation should be.
I think that might be the right point to finish this. I could go on, but I'm conscious of the fact that we are trying to do other things today. Charles Murray, it's been fascinating. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Charles Murray is the W.H. Brady Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's here at the moment to speak to the Centre for Independent Studies Big Ideas Forum. Actually, ABC Radio National will almost certainly have recorded that, and I would be astonished if you can't hear it at a later date. Now, what do you think of the ideas we've been talking about? Should we embrace elitism, as Charles Murray says, change the way we educate the best and the brightest, revive the trades? Send a message to our guestbook or write us an email. You can do both at the website, and that's abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters. Later on Life Matters, should all Australian children learn a second language? But next, depression. Does it run in families?
...88-year-old Cuban pianist Bebo Valdez had to have his arms twisted to make his first solo album. But we're so glad he did. It's a heartfelt love letter to some of the composers of Cuba. Some of them he knew from the 20s and 30s. So it's a real, alive look at over a century of Cuban music. A feature artist on the Daily Planet this afternoon at 2:20 and tonight at 11:20 on ABC Radio National. Thank you. Depression is a common problem, but can you catch it? Research suggests that parents can pass it on to their children. The child of a depressed parent is 3 to 6 times more likely to develop depression themselves. The causes and treatment of family depression will be explored in a public lecture by American expert Dr. Michael Yapko. Dr. Yapko is a clinical psychologist who's in Australia as a guest of the Australian Catholic University, and he joins me now. Welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you so much.
Now, surveys suggest we're in the middle of a depression epidemic, but are we really?
Yes, we are. One of the oldest questions there is are we simply more sensitive to depression, or is it in fact increasing? We have 60 years of survey data to show that this is not just an artifact of research, that this is in fact something that's increasing, and it's a reflection of how people are feeling about themselves and about life in general.
Is this real depression that a clinician like you would regard as depression, or are we too eager to label any kind of sadness or setback, which can be quite legitimate because of what life throws at us, as depression?
I don't think we're too eager. I think there is always a problem of some people labeling anything with whatever tool they happen to have. You know, the old expression, if the only tool you have is a hammer, then everything around you begins to look like a nail. But in the case of depression, we're talking about something that is so enduring, a perspective that not only just temporary bouts of sadness or temporary bouts of feeling bad, but a much, much larger picture of how people go about living their lives, the decisions that they make, the effects that they have on the people around them, how they conduct their lives. It's a much bigger issue than just transient episodes of feeling bad.
Do we know the cause of this increase?
We know that there are many causes, and the causes fall into three general realms: a biological realm where there is clearly a genetic predisposition, a relatively mild one, but a predisposition nonetheless; psychological factors like personal history, a person's way of coping with adversity, how somebody goes about problem solving. And then the third domain is the social domain, the quality of our relationships and how those relationships affect our outlook on ourselves and life.
So, although we know that depression runs in families to an extent, it's hard to say whether it's genetic or it's learned, it's the background, it's the social domain you're just talking about.
Well, part of what we've learned through genetic studies, of course, especially the Human Genome Project, which has redefined our understanding of genetics, we talk about probabilities, we talk about what is termed genetic predisposition. And what the research shows us is that the genetic contribution is somewhere between 0.3 and 0.4, which is a mild to moderate influence, but it certainly suggests that there are other influences that are even more powerful, the social influences and psychological influences. So we understand that there are many factors contributing, but they are not all of equal intensity or equal weight.
So are children at risk of modeling depressed behavior, not learning positive ways of dealing with problems, if you like?
Well, children model what they see. Children learn what their parents teach them. You can't teach kids what you don't know. So, yes, as children are being exposed to higher levels of technological involvement, spending more time in front of computer screens, more time in front of television screens, it has an impact. But in terms of the largest group of depression sufferers demographically are the people who are 25 to 44, and they share many characteristics, but one of the characteristics that they share is that they're in their prime childbearing years. And so when you have the largest group of depression sufferers raising children, it shouldn't be anybody's surprise that children are the fastest growing group of depression sufferers.
How do you treat depression if more than one family member is affected?
Well, that's what couples therapy and family therapy is about. Now, it's ideal when you have the opportunity to intervene with an entire family and improve the quality of communication, give people a voice. You know, one of the quickest and most reliable pathways into depression is to feel like a victim, as if your feelings don't matter, as if you can't be heard. But certainly we want to be able to encourage people to develop good problem-solving skills within the family as well as outside the family. So family therapy is ideal when it's possible.
On Life Matters today, our guest is Dr. Michael Yapko, who's a clinical psychologist and expert on depression. He's in Australia as a guest of the Australian Catholic University, giving a series of free public lectures in Brisbane and Melbourne. They start in Brisbane from Tuesday,
the 14th, which is today, and they go into next month. Now, teenagers, we haven't really touched on them specifically, Michael, experience a lot of highs, emotional highs and lows. I can remember a lot of lying on my bed angsting about things. But when does unhappiness turn into depression and a real problem?
Well, depression isn't, again, just about transient episodes of sadness. It's not just about the highs and lows. I'm more interested in the more enduring patterns, the patterns of how someone thinks, what is called a person's cognitive style, or how someone copes, a coping style. These are things that are far more enduring than the day-to-day moods or the week-to-week little dramas in anybody's life. So what I'm really interested in, particularly with adolescents, is how they interpret the meanings of the experiences that they have and how those interpretations either increase or decrease their vulnerability to depression. But if someone understands this is a transient episode, this is an embarrassment, this is a disappointment, and it too will pass, that's not the one I'm worried about. The one who takes it to the extreme and says, this disappointment means life isn't worth living, that's the one I'm worried about.
The hard thing, I suppose, for parents of teenagers is working out what's transient and what's not when all of a sudden the children, which they have known because of all the big changes that happen to teenagers, seem so mercurial and different.
Well, when people react to events, and this is one of the things I'm talking about in the lectures that I'm doing, one of the things that we've learned about depression is it's really not about events in people's lives. And the more time that you spend trying to tie it to a particular event or a particular episode, the more time, valuable time, you're wasting. It's really about processes, how people think, how people relate. And there are characteristics of people who are most prone to depression, the people who are most likely to face adversity and then turn around and blame themselves and attribute it to their own defects. That increases their probability. But probably the single greatest factor is how it affects the person's view of the future. Do they turn it into hopelessness and there's no reason to try and change things because nothing's ever going to improve? Or do they have a sense of purpose beyond it that they can say, okay, there are adversities I'm facing, but the larger picture of life is still goal-oriented and still able to provide me with satisfaction?
People often talk about the power of positive thinking. Indeed, there's a whole subgenre of book publishing really devoted to this. What do you make of it?
Well, it depends whether it is encouraging magical thinking by telling people to just think happy thoughts or whether it is a much more serious attempt to teach people how to interpret ambiguous life events in a positive way. So take a simple example. I call you up, you're not home, I leave a message on your answering machine, and you don't call me back right away. Well, that's an ambiguous situation. I don't know why you didn't call me back, but if I immediately jump to the conclusion it's because you don't like me anymore or you must be mad at me, just like that, here goes my mood. I start to feel hurt and rejected and abandoned. And it's all about how we deal with the uncertainties of everyday life. We are all constantly having to make decisions in the face of uncertainty, and the quality of somebody's decisions can either increase or decrease their vulnerability to depression.
When it comes to actually treating depression, is drug therapy the mainstay, or are we talking about cognitive behavioral therapy? What are the options, really?
Well, there are many different options. When we look at the two general categories of options, antidepressant medication is one option, psychotherapy is another option. And there are many different forms of psychotherapy, hundreds of different forms of psychotherapy, in fact. And there are merits to each approach, and there are limitations to each approach. There are things about medications that are valuable. There are things about medications that are really not particularly helpful at all, and in some ways are even counterproductive. And the same can be said of psychotherapy. It's always about people being informed enough consumers and dealing with people who have enough expertise in treating depression that people aren't just following formulas. There is no formula for overcoming depression. Each intervention has to be as different as each individual who seeks it. And so while there are certainly benefits that can be had from learning how to think clearly and behave effectively, as is taught in cognitive behavioral therapy, there are other forms of therapy that have a treatment success rate that match cognitive behavioral therapy, such as interpersonal therapy, which focuses on relationship skills. So it really just depends on what the picture is of the person. Mm-hmm. You have somebody who doesn't think very well, they'd benefit from cognitive therapy. But you have somebody who has very disturbed relationships, they'd be doing better in interpersonal therapy.
How much is depression chronic in the sense that if you've had it once, you're more likely to have it again?
That's one of the major problems, especially when people leave it untreated. There is a phenomenon that is well understood in the depression literature that it is highly recurrent, and that once somebody has suffered a depressive episode, it increases dramatically their probability of experiencing a second one if they don't get help, if they just let it slide.
There's been, over the years, more publicity about depression, and there's been, big organizational moves to highlight it. But right. Do you think there's still a stigma attached to it?
There is still a stigma attached to it. And part of the problem, of course, is that even these movements of trying to promote awareness, what's so frustrating for people who work in the field is that so many of the people who are depressed don't think of themselves that way. So they hear a radio show like this one and they say, depression's an interesting topic, but that's not me. They will think of themselves as being stressed and overworked and pressured and harried and harassed and harangued, but they don't think of themselves as depressed. And so from my standpoint, I really am trying to appeal to people in terms of what is your quality of life? How do you generally feel about yourself and your life? Do you experience what's beautiful about life, what's helpful about life, what's wonderful about life? Are you connected to people? Do you feel good about the quality of your life? And for the people who are silently suffering, who have never really thought about it as depression before, it doesn't mean it automatically should be termed depression. Again, we don't want to overdiagnose it, but certainly we want to encourage people to talk to someone, at least someone with an expertise, in order to find out, is this something that they need to be able to address so that it doesn't just negatively affect their lives, but that it improves their lives so it affects the people around them positively as well.
What's the main message you'll be giving in the lectures which begin tonight?
That we have accumulated a massive amount of excellent information about who gets depressed and why, and more importantly, what to do about it. The range of treatments has increased dramatically. The quality of treatments has increased dramatically. Most of the people who want help can get it, but not by just sitting back and waiting. They really do have to be proactive in seeking the help that they want.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Michael Yapko is a clinical psychologist and an expert on depression. He's in Australia as a guest of the Australian Catholic University. He's giving a series of public lectures in Brisbane and Melbourne. You can find details on our website, which is abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. Later, I'll meet the listener guest and how her life began at 50. But next, the value of learning languages at primary school. The overcrowded primary curriculum, are we trying to do too much in the school day? Well, the Primary Principals Association certainly thinks so. The principals have come up with a charter to what they saw as that overcrowding. The core subjects are now going to be English, mathematics, science and history. A number of areas fell off the priority list, and one of those was the study of languages. Well, our next guest says we're being parochial and monocultural, and what's more, we're flying in the face of what the rest of the world is doing. Professor Anne Porwells is the Dean of the Faculty of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences at the University of Western Australia, and she joins me now. Welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning.
Why do you think languages are so important?
Our languages are indeed very important because one of the things that the primary principals would like to do is to stress the importance of literacy. What they're pointing out is that all primary school children should actually have the core skills, one of which they call English, but it's actually English literacy. Now, why we believe that languages are very important is that quite a bit of research has pointed out that actually learning a second language helps with English literacy. So in some ways, what we would have liked to have seen is that they say that languages is a core area, and that includes other languages and English, because both of them actually help each other very much to increase literacy in children.
Is that the only reason, though? It seems to me languages offer more than in helping with literacy in English language.
Absolutely. The reasons why I think it is a pity that the primary principles have come out to identify a number of areas as not being core in the area of languages is that it actually makes little sense, the most sense to the best time to learn a language, a second language, is actually in primary school. Again, this is largely based on very simple, basic research that actually almost any family can do with their children. That is, you learn a second language best in the early years of life. That has to do with the elasticity of the brain. The younger you learn a language, the younger you learn a second language, the better, the quicker you learn it. The most important aspect that perhaps people who are not researchers know about this is that children learn to speak with what is called a native-like accent. If you start learning a language after the years, say, 12 to 14, of course there's a bit of flexibility there, then first of all it is less likely that you ever acquire a native-like accent. Secondly, it will actually take longer to learn because of the less, the brain is less elastic in that sense. Yeah. So that I think would be also a major reason. Perhaps another reason, and this is perhaps something that was not thought about. Australia has now said clearly in all sorts of areas of education that it wants to be a leader in education. What is interesting to see is that those countries that are, on the basis of a range of tests, seen as the leaders in education all have compulsory second language learning in the primary school. So it would be a pity, unfortunate, that as a result of this identification of only four areas, that Australia potentially has the the risk of not being one of the world leaders in education.
So you think we're out of step with the other countries that have that aspiration to be educational leaders?
Absolutely. I mean, there are very few countries that don't have compulsory second language learning. The ones that stick out to some extent are indeed some English-speaking countries. However, the UK has committed itself to making the learning of a second language an essential part of primary school teaching. Of course, Canada has it, and actually the US in many, many states has actually got it as well. So we would be really out of step with even English-speaking countries.
Still, in your statement that you put out, parochial and monocultural, that is strong stuff, especially when you consider Australia is one of the most multicultural countries in the world.
Yes. Well, parochial, as I indicated, is it would go very much against world trends. It goes against the world trends in education. And so from that perspective, if Australia wants to be global, it should actually embrace that. Monocultural is indeed, I indeed wish to pick up there what you've just said about the multicultural nature. In effect, the most recent census showed that in cities like Melbourne and Sydney, almost 30% of people speak a language other than English at home. Now, that is really an understatement because a lot of language is spoken in the homes of other people, especially for younger Australians, say young families, they will speak it in the language in the home of their parents. So we really have quite a multicultural base. In effect, not giving a large proportion of the population the opportunity to continue learning that language would be considered quite monocultural. The other thing that I'd like to point out in that respect is that, and this is perhaps most surprising, it is the British Council that, as some people would say, that bastion of English language, that has come out fairly recently to say that it actually encourages very much bilingualism. And it has the catchphrase saying to people in English-speaking countries, English is not enough. In effect, in 10 to 15 years' time, probably most of the population of the world will speak English as one of their languages. Most people will not be bilingual, they'll actually be trilingual. In that sense, if Australia doesn't follow that trend, again, we will be out of step and will not have that flexibility, that cultural and linguistic flexibility to operate successfully in the global world.
Let's take that. Well, I should say, actually, on Life Matters, our guest is Professor Anne Pauls. She's the Dean of the Faculty of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences at the University of Western Australia. We're talking about the Primary Principals Association. They came out with a charter to try and reduce the crowding in the curriculum, and languages were pushed back from, I suppose, core to second order in that process. And Professor Pauls is not thrilled about this. Now, does it matter which language children learn at school when, as we've talked about, our population is drawn from so many different parts of the world?
It doesn't actually matter. Of course, for the benefits that I've just pointed out, it doesn't matter which language you learn, because you can transfer quite a lot of skills from one language to another, and as I said, to the learning of English. The other thing is that the demand for certain languages in the world actually shifts. A couple of years ago, Indonesian was very much in demand, not only because it was seen to be a pleasant language to learn, but indeed because of our close relationships with Indonesia. These days, Indonesian is not seen to be so popular, and other languages are coming up. So, in effect, you're not going the wrong way by choosing a particular language. They have a lot of benefits. Of course, people will have particular reasons why they want to learn some languages, and as you point out, Australia is very much blessed at the moment with a very wide range of languages that can be learned in primary and secondary school.
Lots of Australian kids learn a language 1 hour a week, that's it.
Yes.
Really, is it worth the trouble when it's such a short time? It's hardly what you'd call immersion, is it?
Yes, yes. That certainly is the case, and that may have been one of the reasons, because in some cases children have access to 20 minutes three times a week. Now, by having so little language, that potentially has the effect of turning children off because there isn't much learning going on. So it certainly is true that if you want to have a successful language learning experience in primary school, you must have a decent amount of hours. Now, it doesn't have to be an immersion program, although, as some of your listeners may know, the Canadian education system has gone for immersion programs, especially English and French, and with enormous success. And of course, the other thing is that if you learn through another language, you actually learn more about the language than just doing a couple of hours. But if you wanted to have, say, a number of hours, then I think normally at least 3 hours a week is what would lead for successful language learning.
Professor Pauls, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Professor Anne Pauls is the Dean of the Faculty of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences at the University of Western Australia. Been talking about the importance of learning languages at primary school. Very interested to hear what you think about that. Do you support her arguments for learning languages at primary school? Have you had any experience with it? Do either give us a call on 0283 1430, that's our listener line, leave a message, or you can go to the website abc.net.au/rn/lifematters, get on the guest book, or send us an email from there. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National, and now this week's Meet the Listener guest. Here she is in full voice.
Searching but not finding, understanding. standing anyway. We're lost in a masquerade. Are we really happy here with this lonely game we play? Looking for words to say. Searching but not finding, understanding anyway. We're lost in a masquerade.
The dulcet tones of this week's Meet the Listener guest, Kate Shaw. Kate had a dream she'd put on the back burner to have a family, and this meant the only singing she was doing was in the shower. But Kate's motto is, wake up, don't take your dreams to your grave. So on her 50th birthday, she thought, it's now or never. Then she dyed her hair platinum blonde and took centre stage, and she joins me now. Welcome to Life Matters, Kate.
Hello, Richard. It's such a great thrill to meet you. I feel like you're an old friend, actually. I've listened to you for so long.
Oh, thank you very much. Now, you decided you didn't want to be invisible just because you turned 50. Now, what, apart from the hair, did you do about it?
Right, well, someone actually told me very kindly, I guess, that most ladies only live to be 82 in Australia, if you're lucky. And my marriage of 32 years has gone like a click of the fingers. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I've got to resurrect those dreams now or I just may not get a chance. I didn't want to be 80 and go, oh, I wish I'd had a go. And it was almost like the impossible dream because I hadn't really sung professionally for 20-odd years and I had done a lot of that in the 70s. And I have a very well-known musician, composer, brother called Tom Fitzgerald, who's been egging me on a lot as well. And my mother's a singer, and my sister's a singer, and they had sort of continued, and I hadn't. So I decided to go and find a singing teacher for a start and find that voice again, and that gave me a little bit more confidence. And then I was egged on to go and do some public performances at jam nights at local jazz clubs and places, and that was really fun.
Because you mentioned you'd done singing before. You worked with some quite big names, didn't you?
I did in the 70s in big Armstrong studios, and they're all quite well known, and I sang in Europe and I sang on a ship and did all those wonderful things. But I always did want to be a mum, and I met the man of my dreams in England, who is still the man of my dreams, who's still my manager, and he's my roadie as well. And my singing teacher introduced me, and my former singing teacher introduced me to this amazing man called Stu, who's had 50 years of experience in the music industry and took me under his wing and told me how to stand and not to stand on the stage. And he did my, you know, my phrasing, and he plays my keyboard. He's an amazing man. He played that keyboard on that CD, and he does all my charts for me, and I'm very lucky to know him.
Now, you were 26 when you moved to Queensland.
I was.
Had your children not long after that.
That's right.
Bjorki Peterson was premier.
Yes.
He had his own vision of what a mother should be, didn't he?
He did. They stay at home with their children. There's no childcare for you out there, so...
Don't you worry about that.
That's so true. But, hey, you know, it was hard because I had no families. My husband's from Sydney and I'm from Melbourne. So I listened to Radio National all the time while I was doing all my chores. I did illustrate children's books and things like that. Did little bits and pieces, but not until they grew up did I feel I was free to pursue my dreams. Not ever dreaming that I would pursue them or have any success.
Obviously your family and your husband are very supportive. What about your friends?
My friends are great, and the people I work with are amazing, and they support me. Like, I had to ask for some time off to go to Sydney to do some recording last year, and my boss is great. I've worked for him for 8 years. But my friends are my cheerleaders, and I'm just so grateful to have them, really.
Were they all nice? Did nobody say, you're dreaming?
Oh, I had plenty of that, but they weren't my friends.
Right, okay. Well, not anymore, are they?
You find out who your friends are and you try and do different things. And don't act my age, whatever that is. But my message is out there that, honestly, no matter how old you are, particularly the baby boomers, I'm flying the flag for the over 50s. You don't have to be invisible. And really, it's fun having a go. If you don't succeed, it doesn't matter. It's just so much fun. And my wildest dreams have been, I just can't believe what's happened to me. The things that have happened.
How difficult was it, though, to get the singing career up and running again?
It was a bit difficult. I had a bit of self-doubt along the way there. That's why I needed people like Stu and my singing teacher and my work colleagues to keep revving me on. And my brother, my wonderful brother, got me down to Sydney to record some of his music because he was composed in residence. I don't know if you know that at the ABC a few years ago. So If it hadn't been for the support, and I think I probably might have given in a few times, but I'm glad I didn't, and I'm now doing corporate work, and I've been in a national magazine last year, and I'm speaking to you.
And Saturday night?
Last Saturday night was one of the most amazing things. 300 guests, we had to audition for that one. It was a masquerade, Truman Capote, masked ball, and
yep.
It was just 4 hours of singing, and it was fantastic. It was something I'll never forget. And
go
they loved
off.
Us. They loved us.
That's fantastic.
So get out there, everybody, if you're over 50, even if you're younger. But if you're a mum and your kids are grown up, there's really so much more you can do.
How old are your kids now?
My kids are 27, and Kelly lives in Adelaide, and Michael's 24 and a half.
Are they in the audience?
They are sometimes. Although Kelly living in Adelaide
yes.
now can't, but they have been in the past, yeah. Yeah. It's really fun.
So you've got this dream off the ground.
Yep.
Where would you like to go with it next?
Well, if the Wish Fairy is listening, it's not about fame and fortune and things like that, but if I really had some wishes, I'd love to do another CD. I'd love to sing a soundtrack of a film, and I'm really dreaming there. And I'd love to actually do some television too, and lots more corporate and private functions. But I'm very greedy, aren't I? But if nothing else happens, I've been so grateful for what has happened. And it's just amazing what life can do. Just got to make sure you believe in yourself, but have lots of friends to cheer you on.
Now, you've had these triumphs already. You were featured in That's Life magazine.
Yes, they rang me, actually.
Won $500 or so, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, I was singing with another girl at the time. I'm very grateful for those early days. Christina's now gone her own way, which is... It was always meant we were going to do our own thing eventually, but we split that money and we got ourselves an outfit because we sang at a big festival earlier last year.
Yeah.
So that was very nice of them to do that.
Now, what advice would you give them, those mums, hankering to bust out, but fighting against the fear that they're now too old?
Well, I don't think that you have to listen to the age number at all, really. Just forget about that. And there were moments when my kids were growing up and my husband was away and I had no mum or anyone to support me. And I'm a bit proud. I'm not very good at asking for help. But I just can't... You just got to hang on to the dream because you just never know. Way down, the kids will be growing up in a click of the fingers and they won't need you so much then. And, you know, your husband, I mean, he won't mind if you go out there, if you've got a partner there to egg you on because you're a happier person because you're following your true heart's desire. I mean, I heard in Brisbane today there's a seniors music quest and one of the finalists is a 99-year-old woman who's got a beautiful voice, you know. And
yes.
I just don't listen to anybody. Follow your heart.
It's
really do.
It's the things you don't do that you regret, isn't it? It's not the things you do.
Exactly right. And life, I just suddenly realised life's just too short. And if you can touch other people's hearts, if I see people dancing when I'm singing or they're smiling, that makes me even more happier that they've forgotten their worries just for a few minutes while I'm singing. And it's just a wonderful feeling. And it's wonderful to do what your heart's desire wants, really. It's just what life, God wants you to be joyful. You can be joyful. You've done your children and you looked after your husband and now you can look after you as well. That there is life after kids and turning 50.
Well, Kate, it's been a pleasure to have you on today.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I've loved speaking with you. Thank you very much for asking me to come on. It's been wonderful.
Well,
and everyone get out there and have a go. Please do.
All right, that was singer Kate Shaw giving us a lesson in, well, following our dreams. And we'll put a link to Kate's website from the Life Matters website. Every Tuesday we talk to one of you and it's always, nearly always, a fantastic conversation for me. So if we ever get in touch and say, come on, don't say no. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National and coming up shortly, the news and then the book show. And this week, Peter Mayers is filling in for Ramona. Hello, Peter.
Good morning, Richard.
What have you got this week?
Well, this morning I'll be joined by Geoffrey Dean. He's a Tasmanian author. I think one of Australia's under-recognised literary talents. He's a short story specialist and his latest collection of short stories is called Under the Mountain. The mountain in this case being Mount Wellington overlooking Hobart. And it's a series of stories about growing up, becoming an adult in Hobart. And terrific stories they are too.
All right. Join Peter for that, which is coming up straight after the news on ABC Radio National. Very keen to hear what you thought today of Charles Murray because he has some very provocative ideas. He puts them out there very interestingly, I think. So remember that. We want your feedback. abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. You can jump on the guest book. You can send us an email. And we will have He was talking, you might recall, about elitism, about basically giving our youngest, brightest kids more to strive against, but putting more resources into them too. Also reviving the trades as a kind of secondary spin-off effect. More of your letters and calls on that issue and others tomorrow. Also, is your GP a good communicator? We're going to get an insight into how doctors think. And what is Generation Jones? See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.